Welcome to another episode of the RockFit Files. This week, I invite Dr. Kurt Nelson, a motivational expert and change expert, on the show. We're going to talk about not only resolutions, but how do you maintain focus on the goals you have set forth in your life. I hope you enjoy it.
In this podcast that I do, I often bring on, I would say, just health and fitness individuals, nutritionists and trainers and coaches and so on. But you're the first motivational coach or behavioral coach that I've had on, and it fascinates me, and I kick myself because I can't believe I haven't done this sooner. So I love delving into it because, of course, I don't call myself a personal trainer. I'm more like a personal guide. Okay. And I try and guide people to their goal that they have, whether that's to get out of pain or to go and enjoy time with family or to get to an optimal level of performance in the sports, in some sport or other. But we, as the training world, I believe as a whole, we don't delve into psychology as much as we truly should, because the brain and how we can affect change is not necessarily through solely dumbbells. So I guess my first question to you is, what are the elements of affecting change? What needs to occur for change to occur? Now, I typically say inspiration or desperation, pick it. But for you, in your professional background, tell me all about change.
Yeah, so change is a multifaceted piece. So what is interesting and what the research points to, you know, we are all, I'll use a behavioral science term and then I'll try to explain it. We are all idiosyncratic in our motivational components. And so that means that every person has their own reasons why they get up in the morning and go and do their workout or not do their workout or whatever that is. And that every person has their own kind of motivational profile. With that, change, as you talk about, is going to be dependent upon a number of pieces within that. And so I like you said, aspiration or desperation. And what again, from a change perspective, we know is one of the biggest impediments to change is that inflection point of when to start. We get stuck in what's called the status quo bias. This idea that, you know, even if it's not great, I'm familiar with this, I'm comfortable with this. And so it's hard for us to move and take that first step to get out. And so that first step is often driven either by desperation, right? Oh my God. I was talking with a person the other day and he's like, I saw this picture of myself and I didn't recognize me, right? I was so overweight. I was so just, crazy. Because in our heads, we can do a whole bunch of things. Our brains fool us often, and I can talk about that too. But it was this desperation moment, or there is that aspiration. I want to, run that marathon. I want to do whatever X would be. And those can be really good motivators to get us to start the action. The bigger piece in the research and in the world that I tend to work in is not so much that start, but it's the continuation of your behavior change. And so part of the issue is, it's New Year's resolutions. We start really strong for those first 2-3 weeks. Then, something happens, we get out of our routine and we don't go back into going to the gym or eating healthy or whatever that would be. And so it's the continuation part of behavior change that I think for most people is really difficult and hard. And there's a number of factors that we could talk about how to help that out.
I would love to, because I find myself starting with projects and having tremendous excitement and energy and focus directed toward that. And my typical modus operandi is to take the ball down the football field all the way down to the 1-yard line and pluck it right there and then walk away. Yeah, and it just sometimes it drives myself crazy. It drives my wife crazy. But what is that? What is there? I won't say a fear of completion, but why, you could use me as an example, but why do we start something with so much vim and vigor only to have it cease?
Yeah.
And then we try and pick it up later, perhaps.
Yeah. So you actually are doing pretty good relative to, I think, many people, if you can get it down to the 1 yard line, because what happens for most people is they get super excited and they might get a first down, and we'll use these sports analogies, right?
Sure.
You might go and you go, oh, we're going, boom, boom, boom. You get three or four plays, we get a first down, and we go the next one. And then we just kind of, I'm tired. I'm going to go take a water break. Right. And then we go. And there's research that is around, and I keep using the word research, apologize for this, but this is where my head goes when we think about this, is there's an element that's called the goal gradient theory. And basically what the goal gradient theory says is that when we have a goal, whether it be, you know, trying to get to that end zone, whatever that would be, is we get really excited and really motivated by that goal at the beginning. And then there's this lull in the middle, and then we typically get motivated near the end. So if we're close to that goal line, we see that 1 yard, and we're there at that 1 yard line. It's like, oh, we just got to get that little bit. And we tend to get remotivated at that point. I use the example when my daughter was younger. She's 12 now, so this doesn't happen anymore. But when she was 2 or 3, we'd walk to the park. The park is about a mile, not quite a mile away from our house. And she'd start off really excited, you know, kind of running forward, holding her hand. And then block 3, block 4, it's like, daddy, I'm tired, you know, and I have to pick her up and carry her. And then about the point where we get where she knows the park is right there and she can start to see it, then she wants down and she will run faster than I can ever run to get to the park, right? And that's kind of the analogy that I use in talking about goal gradient theory. And so part of what we need to be able to do is we often think that willpower is enough. If the goal is powerful enough, I should be able to push through anything in order to get to that goal. And again, what we know is that typically isn't the way that we work as humans. The way that we work as humans is that we need to do a couple different things. One is, can we set milestones between, you know, that piece, which is why football analogy is actually really good, because it is this, all right, we're trying to get into the end zone, but in between that, we just need to get first downs. And when we get that first down, we get close to that first down, the motivation goes up again, right? It's that, oh, we're one yard away from a first down. Okay, so now I just need to get it over here, and I get that little motivational pull to get it over that first down mark or whatever that would be. The other piece is that we need to set the context up so that the behaviors that we're trying to do are going to be easier. And as much as we can get that into a routine or habit, so you take the friction out of this. And when friction, we're talking about anything that impedes kind of the ease or the likelihood of us doing something. So there's been lots of stories and research about people who want to get up and do, you know, go exercise every morning, whether it be jogging or going to the gym or whatever. And even just the idea of laying out your gym clothes and your gym shoes on the edge of your bed or whatever it is in the morning, to take that step out of that, I don't have to go and search for those, or I don't have to think about it. It's right there. It's a little motivational. I open my eyes, I see it. Those are pieces that can make this easier. So those are just a couple of pieces. So I don't know if I answered your one yard at the goal line and why you quit, but there's a bunch of that in there.
No, I think you did. And the analogy you used with your daughter going to the park also gave me this awareness that most people are very challenged to accomplish a goal solely on their own. Mm. And in the case of your daughter, there was a time where you actually picked her up and continued the journey. So therefore, it makes me think that a great way towards success is to actually have help and not, yes, try and do it all on your own. And because there will be times where you need someone to figuratively carry you when you just don't have it. Is that sound about right?
Oh, again, there's lots of research that, again, points to that, to have a partner in there. And actually, the way that you can think about this is, and this can be one person, it can be multiple people. One of the best ways to do continue, like with workouts and other things, is to have a partner that you go with, or a group, a running group, or different pieces. We often will let ourselves down before we will let other people down. We can rationalize a way for ourselves. It's harder to rationalize a way that we've, you know, we were supposed to meet, you know, Joe at 6 a.m. to go running and I didn't make it. That seems more painful to us than, oh, it's 5:30. I got to get up. It's cold. It's crazy. It's okay. I don't need to go running today. Right. So those pieces. That social aspect, though, has a couple different pieces to it. And this is, I think this could be interesting. So one, there's the cheerleader, right? This person who they act as, hey, keep it up, way to go, you're doing great. Kind of that motivational boost to get us to that next level. And those are really important, right? Then there is, and I'm using sports analogies, there's the coach. There's this person who can help you understand, you know what, when you're at this point, you're going to start feeling this. And here are some tips to do this better that you can, you know, to overcome that, to help you through those moments where it's difficult in different pieces. And just letting you know that here are some ways out of that, or just to even, let you know that you're not alone in this and that different piece. And then there's kind of the referee or the accountability piece, that person who, like, if you set up and say, hey, I am going to, get up and exercise 5 days a week. They're the person that, again, maybe you don't even exercise with them, but they're going to hold you accountable to that. Did you actually do that? You said you were going to do that, and make sure and not be nice about it to you all the time either. They can be really mean. And that can be one person can play all those roles, or you can have different people playing multiple roles, or different people playing kind of that, all those roles together. And that can really help.
Yeah, I can appreciate that. There's some events or tasks, projects that I set out to achieve. And I knew that if I kept it to myself, the likelihood of completing those projects were not going to occur. So I actually had to announce it to people, and not one particular person. I wasn't looking for a referee, nor was I looking for a cheerleader or anybody like that. I just know that if I keep it in, it's not going to happen. So whether it's writing a book or paddling long distance or whatever it was, I made it a point to do that. And sure enough, those tasks were accomplished. So I can definitely appreciate that. And the cheerleader for me, yeah, it's nice to have a pat on the back or on the backside or however you want to kind of make that analogy. But how do you know? Like, are there personality traits? Are there types where you, as a professional, will maybe assess an individual and say, okay, this is what this individual needs in terms of motivation, or this is going to be completely different from this person? How do you determine that? Is that something you do, first of all? And if so, how?
It's not necessarily something that I do, but with that, one of the pieces that I think is important here to think about is going back to that idiosyncratic component within ourselves. And so, yes, for you, as you said, you may not need that cheerleader as much. Other people are going to realize that cheerleader is the most important part. I can hold myself accountable, but I just need that. Yeah, they're cheering me on, and that's going to make me want to go ahead and do this. And the best way, and this is with any type of motivation in general, so this is where we think about this, is look at your past behavior. Look at the times where you have succeeded. What are the aspects that go into that? And take a really hard look at those, because this is the difficult part. Again, I mentioned before, our brains like to fool us. We have this element of self-identity that when we think about ourselves, we typically put ourselves into a pretty good light, that we are good people, we have the best intentions, that we are doing these things. And then we have, you know, we get, what gets in the way is the environment, you know, the timing, oh my gosh, COVID, and it's just so stressful now, I can't do these things, and different, you know, it's not within ourselves typically that we weigh the blame. This is generalized. This isn't everybody. And I don't want to say, and there are some people who actually have the opposite, that everything is their fault, and therefore that actually is a negative piece. And you want to make sure that you address that as well. But in those situations, is if you look back at your past behavior, and if you think about it, if I was just a video camera up on the wall watching me, or a a tape of what was going on in my head. What was I saying at the time? What was I doing at the time? And what were those things that helped me? So having that support person there, whether it's an accountability coach, whether it would be a cheerleader, whether it would be, you know, somebody else, or was it something else that was impeding me or helping me along that path? And one way to do that, because again, as I said, our brains try to trick us and fool us. And so our memory is malleable. And so it changes, and it's more likely what we should have done gets kind of transfixed onto what that videotape of what we think happened in the past is to actually start journaling. So start thinking about what it is. What did I do today? What was I thinking about when I was doing that today? And the more immediate you are around that, and then take a look at that after a month or 2 months and see what are those patterns that keep showing up, and then take a look at the pattern and then kind of do a diagnostic on that and say, all right, here are the things that are working when I'm succeeding. Here are the things when I'm not succeeding so much and things that I need to make sure I change.
Well, that's very interesting, because we have asked clients over the years to do the same thing, but with what they put into their body in regards to their eating and their diet. And because almost everyone that walks in and has a conversation, they'll say, oh, well, I eat really well, or I eat healthy. I'm like, okay, well, that's great. That's, you have a definition of what that might be, but let's really pick that apart and write it. I just want you to write down for the next 3 days, everything you put in your body. Yeah. And don't judge it or anything else. Just be the observer if you can. And they bring that information back in. They're going, oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. As long as they're not trying to throw excuses to all these things that they know that maybe weren't the best choices, and they can just look at it in as objective as we can, right?
You bring up a really good point. It's that objective part without making excuses, because that's what we tend to do. The peanuts were out there in different pieces. But I think you also bring up a really good point. I mean, if just any of your listeners, just go ahead and try to track your food for 3 days, and you'll realize, like, you don't realize the little things that you just snack on and eat, right? It's the little pieces, like, oh, it was just a handful of peanut. Well, was it a handful or was it two handfuls or different pieces? This is, again, one of the things that researchers are looking at, is we do things habitually that we don't even know that we're doing. And one of my favorite researchers on this is Wendy Wood, who has done a lot of work on habits. They did this thing where they had people who eat popcorn in a movie theater. They tend to do that. And basically what they did is they had people come in, put them in this movie theater setting, and they had half of the group with fresh popcorn, and half the group had popcorn that was like 3 weeks old and stale and really just miserable, right? And they just put it out in front of them. And if you were in the habit of just eating popcorn at the movie theater, you just ate a ton of it. And they said, no, it tastes bad, but they still just did it because they were in the context of, this is what got there. There's a trigger, a cue, and then the behavior that has been rewarded in the past. And then that's what you do. And so those are some of the things that, when you think about behavior, and again, going back into behavior change, when we start thinking about habitual behaviors, we have to understand what those cues are, what those triggers are that tap into that. And then what is the subsequent behavior behind that? Because oftentimes that happens so subconsciously that we don't even realize that we're doing it in the moment.
That's a great kind of segue into what I was thinking about next is, you know, the movie screen is there. They're almost hypnotized, and they're drawn in for an hour and a half to 3 hours, depending on what film they watch. But we've got screens surrounding us constantly. And I can see myself. I'll kind of confess my own early morning ritual is that after I wake up, shower and get my clothes on, I go out to my laptop, and I'll first check my emails. And then I'll check any messages in the social media. And inevitably, I find 20 minutes of my day looking at cute puppy photos or some stupid human trick or something or other. And it, in the moment, it's just a habit. But if I start taking my calculator out and adding 20 minutes a day for 365 days, I could have learned a foreign language in that amount of time. So I try not to beat myself up over it. But how do we break habits? One, obviously being aware of it is probably one of the first steps, but then what do we do to change? How do we evoke change of habits we don't want?
So this is actually a really tough one because we're talking about avoidance actions or behaviors. We're trying to avoid, again, falling into that trap of A, eating popcorn that we don't necessarily want to eat, or the idea of, you know, as you said, getting up and getting on social media and then playing or being drawn into that for 20 minutes. And again, you're pretty good at 20 minutes, because I will have to admit, I typically get like the 40 minutes of that where I guess like, oh, damn it. I just wasted that time.
It was probably 40, but I'm trying to.
Yeah. Well, we put ourselves in the best light, right? The idea here. So what the research again points to the idea that it's easier to change something if we can replace the behavior, but keep the trigger. So wake up, morning, you know, shower, get ready. All right. So that's your trigger. You got your clothes on. So now, instead of starting with that, maybe change that behavior to doing some of your deep work and saying, I will look at, email and social media at, 10 a.m. as opposed to at 7 a.m. when I'm starting, or whatever that would be. The other way of doing that is saying, all right, so what? How can we interrupt the behavior that we're doing? So can you, and there are different tools out there, particularly around social media and different pieces, that you can restrict the amount of time that you have on. So it comes and it pops and it says, nope, you've reached your 15-minute limit, time to stop. Or even just setting a timer next to you and you go, all right, I'm on email. I have 15 minutes to do this. I will set the 15-minute timer. That buzzer goes off on my phone, whatever it would be. And now I know it's time. Now that's a new trigger to say stop. And then you start that behavior after that.
All right. There was a TED talk by a fellow talking about behavioral change and reward systems and how often, rewards have to be in a different form than many people will assume. Like there's oftentimes where, you get a prize once you have achieved this, whether it's money or a vacation or whatever. And this fellow said, that is not as effective as you might think. Giving monetary incentives is not necessarily, or a reward system of that nature, is not going to be something that really motivates people. So if you agree with that, or if you don't, I'd like to hear that. But if money isn't, what's the carrot on the stick? I guess that's what I'm getting to.
Yeah. So I will agree in part, and then I will disagree in part with that. So extrinsic rewards, which are what I don't know who it was, but is probably talking about this idea of money and vacations and different pieces. They can be very powerful. But they get overused. They are not the panacea that this is the be all end all. And if we just put a little reward at the end of whatever goal that we're trying to achieve, whether monetary or whatever else, that is going to make this happen. That being said, there are a number of other what we call intrinsic motivators, these intrinsic rewards that we get, and those align oftentimes with our self-identity, and not just our self-identity of who we think we are today, but who we ought to be or who we aspire to be. So we have this image in our head of, that there's three different people in our head. Sometimes it's the person we are, the person I aspire to be, and the person I ought to be. I ought to be the loving child and go and visit my grandmother and do all of these things. And then there's the aspirational piece, which is I want to be, the world-class, sprinter, whatever that goal is. And then there's the real me. I sit on my couch and watch TV and eat ice cream, and I don't call my grandma and I don't go out and exercise, so I'm never going to get to either of those other two. So going back to that idea of who we are, when we're moving and making that progress towards either the ought or the aspirational self, we get releases of dopamine and other neurotransmitters that feel good for us. When we do good things for others, there's a social component within. We talked about this before. We are social creatures. When we do things that others appreciate or we feel that others will appreciate, that's a dopamine release as well. We get rewarded for that. Those are these intrinsic motivators that make us feel good. It's a carrot that isn't here's a vacation to Hawaii or here is this, but they are really powerful pieces. And I will tell you, there is real some potential negative if you use extrinsic rewards and those awards are off. So for instance, in a social situation, like if you go and you're trying to get your spouse to cook you, you know, a fantastic dinner or something, and you're trying to influence the other person, you know, the way to do that isn't say, honey, I'm going to give you $10 if you cook me dinner tonight. Right. That
doesn't work is what you're saying. Yeah. I shouldn't do that anymore.
Don't do that. Right. you know, but it's like, but if you can do, there's reciprocity, there's other ways of influence and various different pieces of that. So it's like, you know, honey, I'll do the dishes if you cook tonight, because I know I really like that meal. Or even pray, like, you do this best. And that gives them the internal kind of, oh, I'm proud. Pride is a powerful motivator that I do this better than anybody else. Different pieces along that line.
Okay. We're talking also about a habit. For those that don't give accolades to their spouses or to the people around them, what advice would you give? And it may be just as silly, as simple as just put a timer on your phone and at that point in the time. But what other kind of ways could we just be reminded?
Yeah, as you bring up a really good point, and we see this. So we work a lot with organizations and, you know, different managers within an organization. Some are going to be really good at giving accolades and being really, hey, fantastic job. Others are going to be more, you know, keep it closer to the vest and not do that. And it's not saying that that's necessarily bad. Actually, if you give too much praise, it becomes meaningless. And so this idea of over praising people is probably not good either. It needs to be felt as authentic. It needs to be seen as you're not trying to influence me through this, that you're not using this as a tool. To your point, for those people who don't necessarily espouse and are, hey, glowing about their praise for other people in different pieces, even if there's just, again, it comes back to noticing. It comes back to trying to stop and the normal status quo of how you fall into that routine. So your idea of setting an alarm on your clock once a week or once a day, whatever that would be, and just saying, all right, this is a time to think about what good has happened or what that person has done for me, and then make note of it. The other piece that we see, at least within organizations, is that people say, I'm going to hold off on that praise till the team meeting next week or something like that. And then a whole week passes by and we forget about it and we don't talk about it. So part of what our work with those organizations with is just say, just do it. Figure out a simple way of being able to share that insight with them, that praise for them, that thank you, as quickly and as immediately as possible. We also know that motivationally, that's the most powerful time, is immediately after the behavior. That's what gets reinforced, and therefore they're more likely to repeat that behavior.
I love that you brought in companies, corporations, because I wanted to talk about that as well, because it's not just individuals that we're talking about creating change, but a collection of individuals that make up a workforce or an entity and so on. And it's almost like those personalities within an individual's head that could be the workforce themselves, because they're quite unique and so on. So I imagine there's similarities to the approach you take when working with an individual compared to a corporation, but what are the differences? You know, or tell me the commonalities, but also, how do you approach working with a business? Is it the same way when you work with an individual?
No, it's not. And particularly if you're thinking about, you know, motivating an organization as a whole or a division or even a team within that, you're dealing with going back to that original component. We're all individuals. We're all motivated by different things. And so if you have a conglomeration of different people, they all have a conglomeration of different motivations. And so to be able to customize everybody's individual motivational intervention, so to say, that behavior change, like we need you to do this. And so I need to understand you exactly, gets to be very hard from a scalability component. And so what you're looking for, So what you're looking for, some generalities, some things that people can put their own components in on and various different things. And so this is where, to a certain degree, it aligns to a little bit with the individual piece. As much as we can, we try to have people be involved or even setting their own goals, even within an organization. Now, there might be some parameters around what those goals will be, but they are setting their own goals that lends itself to understanding, hey, what is it that's going to motivate me, but also making sure that I am more committed to that goal. We know that if you are involved in the goal setting process, particularly if you set it, you are more committed to that goal than if it is just placed upon you by somebody else. And that's the same thing internally. We want people to set goals. Part of that goal setting is making sure that you spend the time to think about what that goal is, what are the milestones along the path to that goal to make sure that you're achieving, you know, having those, you know, 10 yard, you know, first downs as you're going to keep that motivation going. So thinking through all of that is a key piece, but then again, tapping into elements of choice on reward. So one of the other factors that we think about is that extrinsic reward that we talked about earlier. That's a lever that companies have. It's harder for them to necessarily be able to understand what that intrinsic, you know, reward is going to be for people. And you can set some things up to help that. Again, aligning with making sure that people understand the purpose of the organization and they self-select into those companies where they're feeling positive about the work that they're doing in various different pieces. But the lever that many companies have is that extrinsic reward. Well, can you make that extrinsic reward a choice? Can you give people options on what that reward is for them? And sometimes that can be cash. Sometimes that can be merchandise, trips, various different things. Sometimes it can be time off, various different aspects around that. And again, this isn't about just their pay, but, you know, things added on and above. And I always caution organizations to do that because there's some interesting research on, oh, you know, things motivate more than money. And so should we just replace everything with merchandise or trips? And that doesn't work either. So there are factors along that line.
So with so many individual workers with their own motivational cueing or personalities, like you say, it would just be too cumbersome to try and figure out what everyone is like. So therefore, we start to see quadrants appear, personality traits, Enneagrams, where we basically corral this style of individual personality into category A and these into category C. We know that they will most likely be motivated by such things. Do you create your own kind of characteristics, or do you go off of something that's already established that you have a lot of validity or faith in?
Yeah, so personality profiles. There are some that are really good, and there are some that are kind of, as I would say, kind of, you know, quackmire, you know, that aren't very valid or reliable. And so, you know, even some of the better ones, the Myers-Briggs is the most popular personality profile in the world. And from all of the reliability and validity tests is if you take it twice, you know, you're 50% chance to get a whole different personality profile. So it's not very reliable. It's not very valid. So it's directional. And so I give people that, and it helps people think about various different pieces. You know, but I would use one of the big five types of things, and that gets more into personality and more research-based, but there are good valid ones. Just make sure whatever personality profile that you use has been tested, that it's valid, that if you take the test today and you take the test next year, that you are not going to be that different in what the test says your your profile is. Now, the interesting thing with motivation, and this is why there aren't very many motivational profiles out there, is that while personality is pretty consistent, it does change over time. We change. It used to be like, oh, once you were 20, your personality is locked in. That has been proven not to be the case. We know we change over time. It just typically isn't a immediate change unless there has been some traumatic experience within our life. But we do change. In 10 years, we look back at who we were 10 years ago. That's not the same person I am today, right? And, you know, if I look out 10 years and I envision, I think I'll be the same, but we know that research shows that we won't be the same person we are today in 10 years. And we will have changed in some of those different quadrants and different pieces. Motivation, on the other hand, can change in an instant. So there are different motivational theories. One of the ones that I really like is called the four drive model. It was developed by a couple guys from Harvard, Nitin Noria and Paul Lawrence. They look at this and say, look, we're motivated, at least within work is where it's the four drive model of employee motivation. Look, we're driven to acquire and achieve. That's that extrinsic piece that we got. It's the money, it's the things, it's the vacation, but it also is the corner office, it's the status symbols, it's that plaque on the wall, all of those things. Those are motivators, they work. But then we're also motivated by more intrinsic pieces, this idea of having social bonds. So feeling that I'm part of a team, that I fit in, that I belong. Bonding and belonging is the next one. And so we do a lot to make sure that we have those positive relationships within work, and we will go above and beyond in order to do that. And that one, I think organizations miss a lot of. They do a lot wrong with that one. Third one is challenge and comprehend, that we are we're motivated by challenges. So this is, again, all right, I want to learn something. Those are motivating for us. I want to, you know, take on this new challenge. We're also curious. And so we want novelty and variety. And so the more that we have that kind of element in it, the more that we're going to be motivated by that. And the last one in the four drive model is define and defend. And this gets a little tricky, but the way that the authors or the researchers that developed this, Noria and Lawrence, talked about it is, look, we used to be tribal. So we would defend the tribe from outward threats. And so if we have that sense of tribe or belonging within a group, and that we don't have tribes anymore typically, but we can have surrogate tribes with our team, our family, the organization that we work for. And the more that we can align around that, the more that we will be motivated to protect them and make sure that they're there. And that gets into the purpose piece of this, of who we are as individual and how much that aligns with the elements that are going on there. So that is a piece where you kind of look at that and kind of tap into any of those motivations to try to drive that. So I don't know if I answered your question. I actually went a long way there. I apologize.
No, not at all. It was great insight, great information. I'm just thinking of the mainstream person who's looking to achieve change in their life, who has gotten to a point where there is desire and willingness. What do they need to do? Well, you've expressed obviously some great ideas, but if we could just take one or two ideas further, what will create that change? And of course, everyone's different. We've already talked about that, but that what does it boil down to?
So I would say the number one thing, if you have the desire and the will and you say, this is what I want to do, I think the number one thing is to remove as many of the friction points, to understand what are the specific behaviors that I need to do on a consistent basis to get that done. So if it's writing a book, if it is losing weight, if it is getting that promotion in my job, whatever that goal is that you are setting yourself up to do, what are the steps that are going to be required? Understand what those are. And then break that down into daily actions, hourly actions, whatever that it's going to be required. And usually it's just daily things that you need to do. And then remove whatever barriers you can from that happening. So if it's writing a book, is it, all right, so I need to write an hour every day. Okay. So if it's an hour every day, and again, this is the other piece, break it down into manageable chunks. Don't try to go, oh, I'm going to write 8 hours every day and I already have a full-time job. And no, be realistic about this. Make sure you're setting these goals that, hey, an hour a day, it goes back to that 20 minutes that you said you're using on social media and different pieces. You could learn a new language if you just took that time over the course of a year. Well, small, daily, consistent factors will make that change happen. So remove the barriers, schedule that time in, make sure it's at a time that you're not going to get interrupted. Those are all big things. And then the second piece that I would really anticipate is we often get what's called the what the hell effect. This idea that, all right, I'm on a diet, I go, it's in the break room, and oh, it was somebody's birthday today, and there was cake or cupcakes there, and I had one. So, oh my gosh, I'm off my diet. So now it's like, what the hell? And I'm going to go and I'm just going to eat. This is today. I'm going to just chow on that pizza and do everything else. No, stop. You know, you had a cupcake. Okay, that's all right. And just give yourself a little flexibility and a little bit of grace and a little bit of forgiveness and say, okay, that will happen. You know, it's cheat days on your diet. It's the flexibility of missing your exercise routine one day because stuff happens. And we know that it happens within our life. And we can't let ourselves then go down that ruminating element where I've just failed, I've lost, and now there's no reason to move forward with this. And so just say, okay, that happened. Build plan for it. Know that it will happen. And just build something that says, all right, I will move beyond that. I will let that happen, or even build in those cheat days into your thing, build in that day off where you're not exercising, all of those factors that come into play.
Well, I think for myself also is it's got to be repetitive before it becomes an actual habitual pattern for me. So there needs to be some energy and effort. And this takes me to your podcast, because in order for me to get motivated, I need more insight and information. And so with Behavioral Grooves, yeah, your podcast, is that what we can expect with your episodes? What is that you talk about in your podcast?
So it's all over the board. So yeah, sometimes we definitely talk about that. We actually just did an episode about New Year's goals, right? And the idea that, wow, we set these goals and we often fail. And so some of the stuff we talked about here was from that. But mostly we talk to really interesting people, oftentimes researchers, practitioners, what we call sometimes accidental behavioral scientists. And we talk to them about what they've learned, what they're doing, various different pieces. And it can be everything from people like Wendy Wood, who's a researcher on habits, to Katie Milkman, who talks about behavior change, famous researchers along that line, to people who are just applying this in work and life. And so it's the person who is, we talked to a avalanche expert from Utah who works with people about avalanche prevention and when they're going in backcountry skiing and doing different pieces and the utilization of behavioral science, because we know, oftentimes we get what's called, that peak fever, right? And so it's like, oh, it's a sunshiny day, it's gorgeous, but we don't take into consideration all of the warning factors that come into place because we see the peak up there and we just get that peak fever and we need to stop and do different pieces. So a variety of different people, a variety of different things, but it's all about why we do what the things we do. And so we try to bring that level and perspective into it.
Beautiful. And I imagine you can find Behavioral Grooves anywhere podcasts are heard, iTunes, yep, Spotify, and so on.
Yep.
And do you have weekly episodes typically?
Yeah, they're weekly episodes. Sometimes even we'll throw in a bonus episode during the week. So, it's been weekly episodes for 3+ years, 270 episodes. You know, we're heard around the world. So listeners in 120+ countries. And it's interesting. And if you like the stuff to understand a little bit more about why we make the decisions we make or why we do the behaviors we do, we have fun with it. It's not as heavy and research-based as some, and we try to make sure that we're laughing and conveying things in a way that people understand and can take action on.
Well, the listening audience in this podcast would do themselves a good service by tuning into your podcast as well. So, Doc, Kurt Nelson, thank you so much for coming on. I truly appreciate your time and obviously expertise and information.
Rocky, thank you. This has been fun. It has been fantastic. And you do a great service as well. So having listened to your some of your episodes, you're out there helping people, and that's fantastic. So keep it up.
You too. Thank you.
Well, that's another episode of the Rockfit Files. I sure hope you enjoyed the show. I want to thank Dr. Kurt Nelson for coming on and just giving us some really helpful hints and ideas on how we can stay on track. I'll see you next week. Make sure that you tell others about this and subscribe if you don't mind, if you haven't already. Have a great day.